This is Primal Screen, a weekly radio show airing Monday evenings on Triple R. Primal Screen is about movies, from the ones on the big screen to the ones you stream. Hope you enjoy the podcast version and feel free to get in touch via the Primal Screen Facebook page or the Triple R website.
Welcome to Primal Screen, a show and podcast all about screen culture, from movies on the big screen to whatever you're streaming. We're broadcasting tonight from the Triple R studios on the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation. This is and always will be Aboriginal land. Big thanks to Fee for the last 3 hours of maps. It's lovely to have you back on the air. I'm your host, Flick Ford, and tonight's show is a special spotlight on filmmaking with three very different directors. We'll hear Vaishnavi Vijayakumar's interview with Filipino-Australian filmmaker James J. Robinson ahead of the release of his debut feature, First Light, which is getting released in cinemas this Thursday. And later in the show, one of New Zealand's most celebrated auteurs, Vincent Ward. Cinema Nova is showcasing Ward's work this week with two special screenings, The Navigator on Wednesday and What Dreams May Come on Thursday. But first up, my conversation with writer and director of the soon-to-be-released body horror, Saccharine, Natalie Erica James.
Thinking of signing up to do this thing.
What thing?
Oh, just a gym program thing.
The reason why you can't lose the weight is because you can't stop.
These generous donors will be your first patients.
So mostly calcium phosphate.
What?
Human ash.
You're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R with Flick Ford. In the new body horror Saccharine, a young, reclusive medical student called Hannah becomes intrigued by a miracle weight loss drug and decides to do her own experimentations in the hopes of attracting her recent crush at the gym. As the weight melts off, Hannah soon senses the presence of something else emerging from the shadows. It is a great pleasure to now be joined by the writer and director, Natalie Erica James. Natalie, welcome to Primal Screen.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Firstly, congratulations on your film. This is your third feature following your debut, Relic from 2020 and Apartment 7A from 2024. There has been a lot of buzz about this film and it has lots of wonderfully gory body horror for folks to dig their teeth into. It's also a story of a young woman, Hannah, played by Midori Francis, who is navigating a serious eating disorder. And I understand that some of the narrative threads are drawn from your own life and family. What was it like combining elements from your own experience into the story, and why were you specifically drawn to tell that story?
Yeah, it's always a challenge when you are bringing in some autobiographical elements. I'd say having some distance from, the events, you know, that are on screen are definitely important because it can be quite intense to kind of relive that on set. But for me, yeah, as it's kind of hinted at in the film, I grew up with parents who had very, you know, opposing ideas about, or, you know, approaches to how they dealt with their bodies and their relationship to food. And so in the middle of that, I kind of had this very intense, extreme experience that I felt like it took me years to unpack so much of the inherited beliefs that were passed down to me. In a way it was, had this sense that I was always going to want to tell a story about this subject matter in some way. And for me, it was also kind of wanting to make the film that I wanted to see when I was a teenager. And, you know, a film that really went into those very uncomfortable places. And in a way, you know, making it okay to talk about and to kind of see your experience reflected on screen, to make people feel less alone. So that was really the impetus for making the film.
So interesting hearing that, because you think about a lot of disordered eating, there's so much shame that is bound up in that, and a lot of folks who experience that are doing it behind closed doors. Sometimes their family and friends have no idea. So really interesting for the audience to be brought into that space, obviously through the lens of horror, but there's also so much tenderness there. And Hannah goes through quite the transformation. How did you practically achieve that effect and work with Midori on her performance and the way in which she holds her body? There's obviously the physical side to it, but there's also this emotional and psychological transformation that we see on screen.
Yeah, completely. I think Hannah's transformation was one of the most key elements that we knew that, you know, if we didn't sell that, the film kind of lived or died on that element, you know. So a lot of care was taken into the design process. You know, we had 7 stages, and it really was a combination of all different departments working together. Obviously, there are prosthetics as well as this bodysuit that she wore in different stages, but a lot of it as well as costuming. And this idea of, you know, having different sizes to accentuate her, you know, her weight loss, and tracking that all through the film to make it feel as seamless as possible. But, you know, you really still feel the starkness of that shift. And, you know, I think Midori's performance as well accounts for so much as well. I just remember when she walked onto set for our first camera test, and she, you know, as soon as the camera started rolling, she just kind of just transformed into, we called her stage one Hannah, you know. And a lot of that performance is about a kind of a deep self-consciousness, right? And this sense of hiding. So we really built that not only into her performance, but also into her wardrobe, this idea of trying to cover up, her hairstyle, this, you know, fringe that she's kind of hiding behind as well. And then we kind of started there and pulled back. But, you know, I think what's really important about Hannah's transformation is, yes, she's losing weight, but actually she's it's not in a way that is additive to her life. You know, in fact, the more that she loses weight, the more it becomes, you know, a barrier to intimacy, a barrier to connection. And, you know, physically she's becoming more gaunt and, you know, weaker and dizzy and, you know, all that stuff. So I think that's a really key part of that, you know, to tell a weight loss story. It's not a binary thing in any way. So yeah, it's complex.
I was thinking of how much she wastes away in the film, and it conjures a lot of, you know, the ill body getting thinner and thinner, and it's taking up less space. And there is something radical about having a woman eating voraciously on screen and claiming space. Our politics have changed quite a lot over the last few years, and there's a lot more awareness around kind of health at every size. Something that I thought was really interesting is how much the narrative is evoked on a visual register as well. And the title of your film, Saccharine, evokes this too muchness, sweet but to the point of making you sick. I noticed a repetition of a sort of candy pink hue that's being used for some of the corpses. Did this contrasting imagery of sweet and sickly inform your creative direction and the aesthetic of the film?
Yeah, completely. I think we definitely had this idea of trying to bring in the almost highs of, you know, having a crush or indulging in a binge, or, you know, just to really convey these pops of color that were almost like the dopamine hits that Hannah was going through. But then at the same time, trying to infuse it with, again, this sense of like rot underneath, or this grime. So candy and grime was like the kind of phrase that we always came back to when we were visually designing the film. And yeah, I think that's right. Like it's, there is a kind of, saccharin is sickly sweet, you know, like it's there's an artificialness to it as well, or there's some kind of something that's not quite right. And it felt like it fit so well to this idea of like Hannah desiring Alanya in this very consumptive way, and this fantasy that was almost being projected onto her. So, yeah, it definitely informed how we designed the film.
You have, as you mentioned before, this queer love story between Hannah and her crush, Alanya, who's played by Madeline Madden. Horror is such a powerful vehicle for exploring marginalised identity, and I loved that combination of this sweet and tender through line in the film between this budding romance. And I won't give away any spoilers, but I am curious to know how you ensured that the queerness was never being collapsed into the monstrosity that we're seeing on screen.
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think for Hannah, I think the queer element is just another layer of her, I guess, uncomfortability with herself in a way. And I think that, you know, so much of the film, she's trying to kind of mold herself into a certain person or a certain image or you know, projecting that outwards into Alanya as well. So, yeah, I think it was trying to bring in a sense of there's a sense that she's kind of outsourcing her identity or her sense of okayness onto Alanya, and the kind of false notion that if this person approves of me or, you know, has interest in me, then I almost consume them into or I'm able to kind of take on their traits as well. So yeah, and I think as well, it was really important to me to have this notion of, because women's bodies are, you know, so consumed in the media, and obviously men have their own struggles as well with all the looks maxing stuff, but, you know, it's a very specific experience, I think, for women in particular, and that objectification, it felt like it really needed to be Hannah and Alanya, like as a woman desiring another woman.
Your film really evokes the cinematic double between these two women in a really interesting way, and quite literal terms in some sense, with this kind of collapsing of body boundaries. And I especially loved how Saccharine depicts the strange presence that Hannah starts seeing after taking the weight loss pills. And the presence is only ever seen through sort of a refracted lens, so the audience is straining to make sense of what we're seeing in the same way that Hannah is, and so we're kind of embodied in her experience. And we're kind of brought closer in, even when we may be wanting to pull away. Was this always how you wanted to depict the ghostly presence, or were there other approaches that you considered in the storyboarding process or while shooting?
No, I think the idea that the ghost is only seen through convex reflections came very early on. You know, I think when you work within a genre that, you know, has a lot of established tropes and language, you're always looking for, like, what makes our menace or our, you know, supernatural rules kind of distinct. So it was always something I was really interested in because of the, obviously with the themes around body dysmorphia, I just felt like the right fit, you know, that this... we're seeing the world through Hannah's lens, and a lot of her shame is kind of being projected onto the world. And so with Bertha as well, you know, I think it's key that she kind of grows over the course of the film, but so much of that is built up in Hannah's head, and so much of it is kind of implied to be her own, you know, projection onto this woman who actually exists.
One thing I really admire about your filmography, you close your films so well. I feel as though there's a real tightness to your storytelling. I've noticed it throughout your work. Is that something that you are conscious of? Are you working with your planning around structure and tempo and pacing?
Yeah, I would say process-wise, I'm very, I tend to gravitate towards theme and images when I'm in that like initial stage of writing. And so I guess if you're very focused on theme, not that it can't change over the course of writing the script, but, you know, how something ends is, of course, almost like your contention for the film, right? Like it's what you're saying with the film. So endings are always like super important. And I would say you almost start with, you know, beginning and an end, and then everything that happens in the middle is, you know, it's an ongoing process. But generally speaking, I would say like I have a very clear idea of where I want the film to go. And then, of course, it's so iterative about what happens in the center. But yeah, super, super key to how I think about story.
Mm. It was a real pleasure to watch this, which is maybe a strange thing to say about a body horror, but it was a real thrill. And I think that audiences will be really excited to see this on the big screen. And I know you're on the press circuit at the moment for Saccharine, but you're a writer and director. Have you got something in the works at the moment?
Yeah, I'm actually about to head over to London for a new project. So I've got a TV series that's a horror series with Apple. So yeah, we're about to embark on that journey. But yeah, it's very exciting because it'll be my first kind of TV project.
Awesome. Very cool. Saccharine will be in cinemas from Thursday. I highly recommend checking it out. Natalie, it's been lovely chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R.
Hi, my name is Natalie Erica James. I'm the writer and director of Saccharine, and you're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R.
May nakikita ka po bang mga espiritu nung bata ka? Binubura ng buhay sa kumbento ang mga alaala ng buhay mo. Siguro, mas mabuti nang ganon.
Sister, masyado na kayong matagal dito.
Hi, my name is Vaishnavi Wijayakuma, and you're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R. Tonight, we have the pleasure of speaking to James J. Robinson, a Filipino-Australian artist based in Los Angeles. With a successful career in photography and filmmaking, he's published regularly by the likes of the New York Times and Vogue, shooting the world's biggest names, including Kylie Jenner and Rihanna, while directing campaigns for brands like Apple and Maison Valentino. His feature film debut, First Light, follows Sister Yolanda, a middle-aged Catholic nun who is questioning her faith following a tragic accident. Premiering at the 2025 Melbourne International Film Festival, where it was in competition for the Bright Horizon section, an awards category which celebrates the ascent of first and second time directors, he ended up winning the Best Australian Director accolade. Welcome to Primal Screen, James.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on First Light. Where did the inspiration come from for such an intriguing premise?
Inspiration really came off the back of the religious discrimination bill that was being discussed in Parliament by Scott Morrison. And I think for a lot of people in Australia, it was this period where the question of like secularism and religion and how much religion should have influence on like actual like legislation and control was really at the forefront of a lot of Australians. And it was a period of feeling quite angry, to be honest. And I had felt a lot of different feelings in response to that and reflect on my own experiences being queer and being raised at a Catholic school and by Catholic parents. And so originally the story came from that feeling and from that anger. But of course, in the process of making a film, which takes months and years and everything to write, my feelings percolated and ended up regulating. And eventually the final film is, I suppose, the regulated response to the religious discrimination bill rather than the angry one.
The film is a co-production between Australia and the Philippines. And to be honest, watching the film, you wouldn't even know that there is an Australian connection. It feels like an international foreign language film. How did navigating the involvement of these two regions impact the filmmaking process?
Yeah, it was really beautiful for me because the film became an excuse to go back to my motherland and, you know, spend time there and reacquaint myself as much as possible with Tagalog and see old family members and go to the parts of the mountains where my family's blood goes back to. And so that for me was an incredible part. The actual production and logistics side, like, it was always kind of like a dance with the two sides. Like, the Australian government obviously was very supportive of the project, which was really wonderful. And they really did give us support from the very beginning and during the phase of development. And at the same time, they obviously have hesitancies because when we're shooting in the Philippines, if anything goes wrong, unlike other films, they can't necessarily help us out if something happens. So it was a bit scary for a first-time filmmaker, and also my producer, Gabrielle Pearson, it was her first time doing a film at this scale also. So there was a bit of hesitancy, and we had to kind of, like, throughout the process, bring lots of people on board to help them feel a bit more comfortable. But ultimately, they were dedicated to making the film as realistic as possible. And in the past, Australia has funded films shooting in Laos or Vanuatu in different places from directors with white Australian background. And I think Screen Australia were excited at the process of doing a film overseas as a co-production, but actually have someone from that culture to be able to add, like, the complexities to it. So that, I think, in the end, was the experience of Screen Australia with the Filipino government. They were just like, we never get an international project coming to our country but wanting to tell a Filipino story. It's always like people wanting to use the Philippines as a backdrop for a different story, or people visiting. So for them, it was a very easy, like, yes, we want to jump on board the project. I suppose the hesitancies was just in different ways of, like, how bureaucracy works, which thankfully my incredible producers were in charge of. And I actually luckily don't know all of the ins and outs about.
I actually saw it at MIFF at IMAX, which was such an incredible cinema experience in showcasing your eye for photography. What was your approach to creating the aesthetics of the film?
Yeah, it's like my background is in photography, and from that you kind of learn how to tell a story in a single image. And all of a sudden with this film, when it's like I have 24 images per second, like, it was just kind of like overwhelming to me. But luckily I have my cinematographer, Amy Della, who went to the same university as me and I've been working with since I made my graduate short film at Swinburne University. We very early on figured out what the visual language of the film was going to be. We wanted something that was going to be beautiful and, like, capture the world and have, like, a real tapestry feeling to it, but we didn't want it to be overwhelming. And so kind of walking that balance of making it really beautiful but through restraint rather than through, like, tricks or through, like, the crazy new technology. That was a really interesting way to approach the film. And I think the way that the film looked was always going to be really important to me as a photographer. And I think everyone on set knew that. So my production designers, costume designers, and actors, they all really did their best to help give me the vision that I had in my head.
And was shooting on 35mm and 4K really important to you?
Yeah, I mean, it was my dream to shoot the whole film on 35mm just because all my short films were done that way. Most of my music videos are shot that way. And all of my photography career, I've only shot on film. And it is, of course, like, there is an aesthetic layer to it, but for the most part, it's actually kind of like a workflow thing. Like, when you're shooting on film, it's like you're not going back and being like, did we get the perfect shot? Like, you kind of just get it and, you know, you can see roughly what you're shooting when you're shooting on film, but you can't see it in, like, perfect detail and you don't know if it's going to come out perfectly. Something about that where you kind of, like, leave space for things to go wrong or to become better than you ever imagined. Like, that's just a process I like to do. And shooting on film allows me to have that approach and make sure that I'm never being too perfect. However, shooting on film in the Philippines, where there isn't actually a lab, and, you know, if we shot a film, we would have had to send it to Taiwan or to Japan. And if we did that, we weren't going to get the footage back for at least 4 days. So I did compromise and shoot on digital. And I think it was actually a nice way for me to start using what I kind of consider to be a bit of a new medium to me. And it did allow me to, yeah, leave the camera department a little bit more to my cinematographer and offer me the time to spend more time with my actors and make sure performance was going to be as well done and thought through as possible.
The landscape and locations are incredible, from the decaying church to the sterile hospitals and vast remote mountains. Like, even the audio aspects, like the howling wind and the sounds of animals, just felt so incredible to experience that in cinema. What research was undertaken to find these locations?
Yeah, oh my God, so fun. So fun you got to watch that in IMAX of all places. It's sort of great cinema and great sound system. Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the mountains when I was writing the script. I want to make it as authentic as possible, not just for the project's sake, but also just for my sake and the fact that this film was really my, like, homecoming in a way, and wanting to really reconnect with the culture with as much, like, thought and a meticulous approach to capturing everything as possible. And so, yeah, finding the locations was really just in those periods that I was up in the mountains, and I was often just walking around a lot and finding places that felt right. And some of those places ended up being the final places in the film. Some of them were obviously difficult to get permits to shoot in, and logistics and things come up. But for the most part, there was it was a really long period of scouting because we really wanted to approach everything with attention to detail as possible. And like, I wanted to make sure that like things were the right colors and had the right feeling to them. And also that the people that live in the areas that we're shooting were going to be excited to have us there. I didn't want to shoot anywhere where people were hesitant to be, you know, have their backgrounds captured on film. Yeah, finding the locations was a really fun time. A lot of early mornings and a lot of driving around in cars, but also the chance to meet so many people from different backgrounds in the Philippines. So it was really rewarding.
Ruby Ruiz's portrayal of Sister Yolanda is so powerful. She holds this quiet strength. What convinced you that she was the perfect lead for this story?
She has this demeanor of like, she is so beautiful and also has this just cheeky energy to her. And I think that's what I needed. Like, I think this character of Sister Yolanda, like in the wrong hands, could be like too overly pious and like lack a bit of complexity. And so when I first saw a video, it was actually a video of Ruby Ruiz when she won Best Actress Award at Cinemalaya in the Philippines, which is a film festival. She won it for this film called Iska, and I actually hadn't seen the film Iska at the time, but there was something about the way that she was walked up to the stage, something about the dress she was wearing, something about the jokes that she was cracking when she was winning the award. She was the person that I pictured when I was writing the screenplay. I didn't know if we were going to get the chance to get her, but because I'm so visual, I kind of need to have a face when I'm writing things. And so when I finished the script and finally showed it to her, it was amazing that she had time and that she was so willing to jump onto the project, especially for a first-time filmmaker. There's just a complexity that she adds to everything. And I really wanted a face that can say so much with so little. And Ruby, even when she's just relaxing or I see her looking out the window, there's just like a universe in her eyes and in her gaze. And that was just something I knew would bring so much to the film.
If you've just tuned into Primal Screen now, we're speaking to filmmaker James J. Robinson about his debut feature, First Light. So you've worked on some incredible projects across your career, including shooting big brands, directing music videos, and photography for Vogue Australia. How has this other creative work influenced your own artistic vision?
I think being in that world was very intoxicating at first as like a young person trying to make his mark and figure out what, you know, my creative voice was going to be. But really, I always knew that I wanted to be a filmmaker and to direct films. And so that work always kind of felt like a, not a detour, but maybe kind of like a sandbox for me to like test out different styles and to figure out what really worked for me. And like this kind of energy that that attracts and really gave me a perspective on life and getting to meet so many different people. So I think that I can attribute that period of my career to giving me a kind of complexity and perspective on the ways that different people live, while also getting the chance to test out different ways of figuring out what I like visually and like what carries weight for me and what kind of symbols work for me. And yeah, just expressing myself. And there were so many times in that field where I'd do things and I wasn't happy with them. And sometimes doing those shoots are even better than doing ones that go really well because it teaches me something about what I'm trying to say and why something doesn't feel right when I say it in a particular way. So I think, yeah, it was all a really awesome pathway for me to eventually get into my first film. And I think out of everything that I've done, the film is definitely the thing that feels the most like me as an artist and as a person.
First Light sheds a light on religious corruption, similar to your protest piece, Burn the Blazer. From your perspective, what role can artists play in holding institutions to account?
I think it's like artists are just like something that the institutions can never control. And it's kind of just this wild card of like people are gonna, you know, if you're gonna affect people, there's always gonna be some kind of response. And I think that art is at times feels to me like it lacks like the immediacy of like other kinds of like charity work or protest work. And there's so much part of me that like when I do that work, it feels like I'm doing 10 times more than, you know, making a film or taking a photo. At the same time, like an image's ability to carry so much more meaning and evoke an emotional response, I think is really important and gives people perspective and empathy on other experiences. And, you know, like my way of kind of understanding the world has really been through watching films as a younger person and reading a lot of books in particular, like literature is a very big inspiration for my film practice. And I think having myself learnt so much about the world and like process my own feelings through watching other people's art, I think that always became a reminder to me that while sometimes it can feel futile, at the end of the day, the ability to evoke emotional responses from an audience is really, really powerful and something that institutions can never really silence.
First Light isn't your first film about the Philippines. You've also made a short film that documents a personal investigation into your mother's youth under martial law. What is it about your connection to the country that keeps drawing you back as a filmmaker?
I think it's more just like my own desire to understand my history and my background. And going to the Philippines with a project is different than just going and, you know, seeing family and being a tourist. It gives me the opportunity to actually spend time to research, like to have financial backing from Screen Australia development phase to give me time to spend in the mountains. It's like that is so incredibly special for me as an artist and just in general as a person trying to figure out my place in the world and what I have to say and what my perspective is. And so I think going to the Philippines has just been a part of my artistic process in my 20s and now in my early 30s of figuring out who I am. And so it's not exclusively what I want to continue saying always as an artist, but I think at this stage in my life of still trying to reconnect with a country that felt so distant from me growing up I think it's an important part of these early stages of my career, and I'm excited to always go back to the Philippines for the right projects. But I think I have a lot more to say in different places now that I feel like I understand this really integral part of me.
The film is as much about a personal crisis of faith as it is about institutional suppression. What role do you think individuals can play in creating systemic change?
Wow, that's a really beautiful question and a really heavy question as well. I think the individual has so much power. And the thing is that these institutions and these systems of power try and convince you that you don't have agency and that we don't have power as individual people. And so that kind of disincentivizes us from ever speaking out because it's kind of like, well, what can I do as a single person? But when you look back through history and you know, so much of writing this film was really interesting because while it is a film that is like criticizing parts of Catholicism, but definitely not all of it, just the more institutional side, it really brought me into researching, you know, figures like Joan of Arc, who just are like the most unassuming single people. But when you look back at history, it has been individual people who have had the power to turn the entire tides of like the human truth and like the powers and institutions around us. And so I think we really are trained to think that we don't have power, but so much in researching this film and seeing the people around me is reminding myself that we do have that power, and it's actually really important to remember that we do.
Thank you so much for this chat, James, and congratulations on such a stunning feature film debut. I'm Vaishnavi Widyakuma, and you're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R.
Thank you.
Triple R. You're listening to Primal Screen on Triple R with Flick Ford. Regarded as one of the most significant and original creative voices to come out of Aotearoa, New Zealand, Vincent Ward is a renowned artist, filmmaker, screenwriter and producer whose career spans more than four decades across cinema and contemporary visual art. From his breakthrough feature Vigil from 1984 to his medieval odyssey The Navigator and the epic adventure Map of the Human Heart, exceptional visual and emotional ambition, and the Oscar-winning What Dreams May Come. It is a tremendous honour to be joined live in the studio by filmmaker Vincent Ward. Vincent, welcome to Primal Screen.
Thank you, Fleck. I'm really pleased to be here.
Well, over the weekend, you had an exhibition opening at Void Melbourne, which is showcasing your art for the entire month of July, actually finishing up on July 25. The exhibition is titled Palimpsest Landscapes, and it prompted me to reflect that much of your filmography is something of a palimpsest, with traces of your earlier work surfacing in your later films. And I think you definitely bring a painterly touch to your filmmaking. What actually came first? Was it art or film?
Oh, definitely art came first. I started as a painter You know, I used to draw all the time as a kid. Well, I started as a kind of concussion orientated athlete who kept injuring himself and then got forced into the art room. So basically I ended up as a filmmaker because of a range of head injuries.
You need to put that on a film poster somewhere.
Yeah, I reckon. Max Headroom.
Yes, absolutely. And what do you think about that observation about you bringing this painterly approach to your filmmaking? Do you think that's true or too reductive?
Yeah, well, I tell my stories visually, and I often have characters, with the exception of Robin Williams, who are inarticulate, and so, you know, I observe them. You know, I come from a farm originally. I observed animals and behaviour that way, and that's how I. And up until the age I was sort of probably 8, so my, you know, the women in my the kids in my class at school many years later said, "Well, we didn't even know you talked."
Meanwhile, you're thinking up movies in your head.
Well, I don't know about then, but my father was a storyteller. He just loved storytelling, and so he'd always tell stories about people. And because he was of Irish descent, you know, the Irish really don't tell stories with a happy ending. So they some of the stories tended to be a bit on the dark side, but it brought the whole community alive. From where I grew up.
I noticed that many of your films are sparked by something in your life or an experience that you then seem to incorporate into a story or use it as a sort of jumping off point. And while there is, of course, this connection to the real, your filmography is kind of best known for being this sort of dreamlike experience with these stunning visual set pieces. I'm interested in why you're interested in this boundary between the real and the imagined.
Oh, well, I think, you know, growing up, I spent a lot of time on my own, isolated on this farm, and my brother and my two sisters suddenly vanished to boarding schools. I was suddenly left with my mother, who's a little on the crazy side at times, wonderful she was. So I wander off in the hills. Both my parents were World War II veterans, and my mother was in the British Army in the Middle East. My father was in the New Zealand Army. And so I'd go off in my dad's army jacket with a rifle when I was about 8 and with my imaginary battalions of sheep and imagine stories, you know. So so I guess I was a bit of a dreamy kid, and I'm probably quite a dreamy sort of adult.
Mm.
So, you know, if I'm honest.
But what about that turning to your lived experience? Because you do seem to, there seems to be lots of parts of your real life littered throughout your work.
Yeah, sure. Well, I always try to find, I think I aim, you know, I work very hard to do stories that are authentic. So even though there might be something fantastical about them, they're carefully structured and they anchor into a kind of gritty real world. You know, where rubber meets the road, and that's very important to me. So, and then I find those stories out of experiences I've had. For example, on one of the films that's on at Nova this week, The Navigator, A Medieval Odyssey, I was in Germany. I was in my 20s, and I'd just been to a medieval city, and so I was full of these medieval images. And then I, having no money, I tried to cross the road, only it was a, you know, four-way autobahn on each side, so it was eight roads of traffic roaring, and I think they go about 120 miles an hour or more. And I had a backpack on, so it was sort of like an automaton trying to jerk my way across this road. And suddenly, somewhere in the middle of the road, as I was dodging traffic, I imagined what it would be like for a medieval person coming to the 20th century, because it was in the 20th century when I made the film. And suddenly seeing this river of traffic, like a river of fire coming at them, what would it be like if you came from another time, the medieval times? How would you see our world now? And so it's a medieval view of the 20th century or the 21st century. And, you know, so you get all these wonderful parallels. You get, back then it was AIDS, but now it's COVID. And my story is set during, starts in the black time of the Black Death in 1348 in Cumbria in the north of England in a remote snow-clad community. So they imagine an afterlife that's because they believe they've, you know, they have tunneled into the afterlife. But in fact, it's, you know, 20th century New Zealand. They think they're in some sort of paradise at first, and then they think they're in some sort of hell. Mm. It's probably pretty close to the truth.
I want to take a step back. I know that during the 90s you worked in Hollywood as a director and a screenwriter and a producer, and you received a story credit for Alien 3, and you also developed a lot of the material that was later became The Last Samurai. I imagine the industry there was quite different from what you'd experienced in New Zealand. What were some of the lessons that you learnt from that time, and did it change how you approached filmmaking and writing?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I'm still trying to process it and dodging for time. What did I learn there? Look, it's sort of the Rome of the, you know, 20th and 21st century, isn't it, for filmmaking? And you get to work with these incredible people, and you get to, some of them are your neighbours. You get to interact with them. You get to go out with them, you know. So that was kind of a thrill. These people with enormous talent that have been gathered from all parts of America and other parts of the world. And so super bright. But then also there's a side to it which is incredibly ruthless and ambitious. And because it's the films are made at such a mass scale, they have to please a sort of mass audience, so that I guess more and more they've become emulsified a bit. You know, it's hard to make a, you know, I went there thinking Hollywood would make my films. And so there's always this sort of internal conflict between yourself and the system. And you're always trying to convince them to make your film. And, of course, they think, well, you know, this guy's talented. If we could just get him to do one of our films, then, you know. So it's always, it was very much that sort of interaction. Compared to working in New Zealand and Australia, because I lived in Australia for a long time also before going to LA, you know, we've got two industries in both countries. One is, you know, the larger American films and TV series coming to our, and using our country as a base, our countries as mutual countries as a base. And we've got the more, sometimes the more personal films. It's very hard to get those films made at any scale. You know, even high-end independence sort of quite difficult. But if you can get them, you know, so you don't ever, I guess this, the rule applied to both countries or three countries, you don't, you can't have an expectation then your film will get made. You just, you know, take the weekend off, get up in the morning on Monday, work all week, and try and survive as best you can. And then and everything I do I consider an absolute folly. Mm. Everything I do is a mistake. But then some of the mistakes get really dignified. Mm. And I go, yeah, well, maybe I'm not as stupid as I thought I was. Or and then sometimes I think maybe I am. So it just sort of works like that. That's what I learned. There was no – there were differences of scale and expectation, but basically the same – work ethic goes, you know, everywhere you work.
I read that you'd planned to cast Werner Herzog in Map of the Human Heart, and unfortunately the scheduling didn't work, so you ended up having him as this forlorn face in hell calling out for Klaus Kinski as Robin Williams tries to avoid stepping on him. When you're working on a story, how often do you already have the actor in mind, or do you feel yourself inspired to write after a particular performance?
Well, I always wanted to work with Jean Moreau in Map of the Human Heart, and Max von Sydow, I've been a huge fan of. Robin Williams, I've been a huge fan of. Samantha Morton, who was an interesting experience for me, but I thought that she was an extraordinary actress. And Kiefer Sutherland, it was great to work with. But with Werner, I have to tell you this story just a little bit more detail, if you'll allow me. I'd wanted to cast him in this film, Map of the Human Heart, that I made in the Canadian Arctic and in Canada, and it was part of it was set in Germany during World War II, in the closing days of the war. And my character, an Inuit, an Eskimo, it ends up being parachuted into Germany because he's part of a bombing run over Dresden. And he ends up trying to escape out of Germany with a mad German taxi driver and driving through a minefield where there's a families of piglets, and they're so I always imagine this mad German taxi driver insisting on driving through the minefield and these piglets exploding like 30-40 feet above them, these little wee piglets. I don't know, it sounds gory, but and then when I cast him as a face in hell, and he kept saying, you know, this is in the next film, What Dreams May Come, when he kept saying, Robin, step on my... He was wearing glasses. This is a guy, you know, lying with his face up in a sea of faces, saying, Robin, step on my face. I never smashed the glasses. But step on my face. Don't worry. I go, thanks, Verna. Great.
An amazing get. As I mentioned before, for folks who have just tuned in, I am speaking with filmmaker Vincent Ward, and I mentioned before that your work spans over four decades, which is a remarkable achievement. I'm curious to hear what you've noticed, the key shifts that you've noticed in this time in the film industry, and more precisely, what you see as the future of cinema in New Zealand, where you're currently based.
Well, New Zealand, Australia, probably pretty similar. Mm. Well, obviously, a lot of independent films, you know, they've reached a sort of brick wall. While it's become a lot easier, so you could make a film with your iPhone. So I'm not saying anything new here, but you can make a film with your iPhone, but then so are 10 million other people. Mm-hmm. And so apart from YouTube, you know, will anybody see them? And will the quality be... you know, able to compete? And is there anything, are there any cinemas to show it in? And so, or are they prepared to? So, you know, with Netflix and other streamers, you know, all of this is nothing new, right? But I'm sort of excited by AI. I mean, I know that it's the devil in a new dress, but I quite like that, you know, I like the dressing. I think it's great. I mean, I think it gives us an opportunity. There's a hell of a lot of crap made on AI, so most of it's complete junk. So if you don't have any real feel for it going in, you won't have any real feel for it going out. But if you're stubborn and you fight it day in, day out, you can actually create some interesting work. My artwork I don't create with AI. I do it, you know, physically, you know, or with cameras. But, you know, I believe in handmade objects. But for certain things, it can be very special and open a portal.
So do you mean it as approaching both, including both within the film, a bit of AI and a bit of...
For film, I think AI is great.
Okay, that's interesting.
I'm a bit more sceptical about it with fine arts, but I'm working on a graphic novel of the Alien series I did a long time ago that I worked on, you know, but... I just did a story for it. I was meant to direct it, and then they wanted to go in a different direction. But at the moment, I'm working on that. Yeah.
And you don't want to use AI in that work.
Well, for that, I do use AI because it's, you know, it's helped for that kind of illustration rather than you know, artwork that I exhibit. I find it really helpful. But I've also worked with about 9 illustrators on it and do a lot of illustration and drawings myself.
When are we? I feel like
I
this
don't
is a terrible...
know. It's like there's a negotiation that's got to happen. I'm just, you know, it's like another one of my follies.
I'm very excited to see it when it is done. We should mention that tomorrow night you'll be speaking with James Hewison at the Kelvin Club. And as I mentioned before, on Wednesday and Thursday this week, Cinema Nova, you're going to be doing some Q&As there after screenings of your films, The Navigator and What Dreams May Come. Why do you think that these have remained in the popular consciousness? Why do you think people are drawn to revisit it on the big screen?
They're very, very visual films. Mm. They have strong performances and iconic moments. Reviewers consider them quite original. They've stood the test of time. I believe they're compelling stories. So there's something different that you don't get the same with these films. You wouldn't get the same experience on television, or you wouldn't get it, you know, on your computer. They're meant to engulf you. They're, this new film. I mean, I looked up ChatGPT to say what I should say, or if there's anything I should mention, you know, before this interview. And they said, well, you know, have a think about The Odyssey. You know, it relates to what you've done in both what dreams may come and The Navigator, and that they're both myths, strong visual storytelling with, centrally committed characters on a journey, forging some sort of path and creating a sort of hopefully a rich layered experience.
Well, also audiences get to watch the film and then hear you in conversation afterwards, which is a lovely way to see film.
They can stone me afterwards, exactly.
They can indeed. And for our lucky Triple R subscribers, we do have some double passes to give away. So you can reach out to us on Instagram at primal_screen_show with your Triple R subscriber number, or you can actually just give us a call now on 0466 981027. I might even get you to answer the phones, Vince, when they come through.
Sure.
It has been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, Vincent.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. I really appreciate it.
And thank you to all our guests for speaking with us tonight. Writer and director of the new body horror Saccharine, Natalie Erica James, and filmmaker James J. Robinson with his debut feature First Light. And both of those films are in cinemas from Thursday. As always, you can listen back to the show on the Triple R website or app, or subscribe to the Primal Screen podcast and never miss an ep. Big thank you to Jack Rowland for editing the podcast each week. It is good night from me.
Thanks for listening to Primal Screen, a weekly radio show airing Monday evenings on Triple R. Hope you've enjoyed the podcast version, and feel free to get in touch via the Primal Screen Facebook page or the Triple R website.